Hello and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast Cybersecurity for the Connected Car. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator with today's speakers, Bob Lee from RTI, Mark Brown from Gramatech, Mike Borse from Polarian, and Sean Bhattacharya from LDRA. Today's schedule consists of about 50 minutes of presentation, leaving 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, let's run down some important features of your viewing console. It consists of a set of windows that you can close, open, move, resize, maximize to, for your personal preference. On entry, you'll see pictures of our presenters in the presenter window, biographies and presentation slides, and a Q&A slide. There are seven icons across the bottom of your screen. If you click on the icon to the far left, that will reset your viewing area to a default configuration. The rest of the icons you can open and close as you wish. You can hover over your mouse over each window to see what it's controlling. There is a handout icon I'll point you at third to the right. That opens a handout window that with the slides, so you can follow along with it or download for future reference. The Q&A window allows you to participate in today's event. You can simply type questions into the Ask a Question text box, then hit Submit. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the event. While the question is still fresh in your mind, we'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A. And if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you could submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to help. We have an all-star lineup of presenters today. Mark Brown, he is one of our presenters. He's bringing more than 25 years of technology leadership in his role as Gramatech's Chief Marketing Officer. Before he joined Gramatech, Mark was Group Vice President of Product and Solutions Marketing at Polycom, where he helped define and market Polycom's workplace of the future. Prior to Polycom, Mark spent several years supporting the embedded software markets with Intel, Wind River, and IBM. Earlier in his career, Mark was also a software engineer with Motorola, Corning Research, and GE Aerospace. Our second presenter is Sean Bhattacharya. He serves as the Director of Business Development and directs U.S. Field Engineering for LDRA. Prior to this, he worked as a field application engineer, deploying LDRA software solutions for a large number of major defense, commercial avionics, medical, and automotive vendors to meet industry software certification. Over the course of his career, he worked with major defense systems and integrators as software engineer and software engineering lead as well. Mike Borse is our third speaker. He's enjoyed a wide variety of experiences over his 30-year career, from programming and development, management, project and product management, IT government, security and risk management, among other capacities. He's worked with several talented engineers and entrepreneurs and executives worldwide in a lot of markets and business sectors. He's working with the community today, solving complex problems and innovating solutions. Mike formally joined Polarian in 2015 as a product management leadership for key vertical markets and Polarian's variant management solution. Bob Lee, he brings 15 years of experience today, developing new markets and building technology companies to his role of director in new markets at RTI. Bob graduated from Queen's University with a degree in mathematics and engineering and has used his education in control and communication systems to engineer embedded solutions for a variety of industries, including energy, manufacturing, and transportation. Each venture, he has led the charge to create new technologies for emerging markets and disruptive applications. Welcome, gentlemen. Mark Brown will be kicking things off today. Mark, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kurt. And good morning and good afternoon, everybody. I look forward to good presentations today and hopefully a very active Q&A session. I want to spend about 10 minutes talking about what Gramatech does and how we support organizations that are developing new technology and software for connected cars. This is certainly a growing area, and it's an area where software development evolution and new technologies is going to be needed to meet some of the ongoing challenges. Now, as I get into this, I think the very unique thing about the automotive landscape is the dramatic evolution that's occurring. There are a number of very well-known systems in automobiles today that are being connected more broadly within the vehicle itself, as well as a number of new capabilities from advanced driver assist systems all the way to fully autonomous driving vehicles. With these new systems, as well as new types and new levels of connectivity come a number of new complexities. What Granitech has found interesting is organizations evolving both architectures, looking at their hardware. Many organizations are moving from small microprocessors to more powerful multi-core processors. And in some cases, those multi-core processors are running systems with mixed criticality. One core could be running some applications that are safety critical. Some cores that could be running the infotainment system and maybe environmental aspects that are less safety critical. So you've got challenges on the hardware side with the advancement and the introduction of multi-core becoming more prevalent. You've got the fully connected, always connected systems to the broader internet these days. And again, with the connections to the internet, you're opening yourself up for new types of attacks. And certainly attacks will occur. We see news on a weekly basis about the challenges of automobile systems being hacked in by different types of organizations or hackers having fun. In fact, the recent Jeep issue that most of us are aware of was a funded study by DARPA, right? Two engineers were funded, I think, at $80,000 to look at certain vulnerabilities in connected vehicles today. And it just showcases the issues that, in really the challenges that the automotive markets are dealing with. So there's a whole host of complexities and drivers that teams need to be thinking about that will really need to fall back to how do you develop software differently to ensure that what you develop is not only safe, but it's also secure. And in all honesty, you're never going to be safe unless you're secure. So businesses got to really look at those things in parallel. Now, what Granitech does is Granitech helps organizations automate aspects of software analysis throughout the development process to help teams have a better understanding of potential defects and vulnerabilities that will impact a system in its deployed state. There are a number of studies that certainly prove out that teams that automate software analysis through the development of the software from the beginning all the way to the time that they go post-deployment have a clear advantage over those that wait till the end or maybe use more traditional QA processes. Some of the key benefits that full software analysis provide certainly provides deeper analysis of your overall source. I think one of the things that many organizations struggle with is getting very deep and full coverage of their source code. It's very difficult to get 100% coverage with testing, but software analysis gives you the ability without the investment of creating all of those test cases or trying to understand the various results from penetration testing and fuzzing. Static analysis gives you a very, very easy way to analyze your source code during your build process, whether you're doing continuous integration and build or you're doing more batch builds. It gives you a very easy way to integrate into the build process, to scan the software, scan the incremental changes, and then provide results back to your team. It's very easy to integrate. I think one of the nice things about static analysis in particular is it can be integrated into a development project at any time. It's nothing that you need to pick up front. Certainly having it up front is going to give you that assurance, but it's something you can adopt at any particular time. And lastly, it can help you validate a lot of the third-party and open source code that you're going to be relying on and your system is relying on to give you that full functionality you're looking for. And what we have found is that teams are using a great deal of open source and are using a great deal of third-party code, whether that code is operating system, drivers, whether it's middleware, it could be firmware. And if your code has been fully validated and safe and secure, but it's linking against the driver that has a vulnerability, and, you know, we find more and more of these. I think all of us remember in the networking space and not too long ago the Heartbleed problem with the OpenSSL library. It was a library that was around a very, very long time. but had a very fundamental flaw that could be found with static analysis. So it just gives teams that extra assurance and visibility into potential defects and vulnerabilities they need to be aware of. Now, the thing that you have to do also keep in mind is static analysis tools have evolved dramatically over the last couple decades, and not all of them are equal. You've got a lot of open source lint-like tools that are very good at helping people conform to coding standards, look for basic API misuse, but unfortunately they tend to be procedural specific, and they're not whole program capable of analyzing the whole program. You've got advanced code analysis tools, much like CodeSonar and other commercial tools that fall in this particular category. These are very sophisticated analysis tools that can help you find the most difficult issues. And some of those that you're going to come across that are difficult to find with any other techniques are going to be concurrency-related issues. If you're trying to really validate that your applications are behaving correctly on a multi-core chip, concurrency issues, whether it's deadlocks or race conditions, tend to surface themselves once your applications have been deployed. Many of the static analysis tools, in particular CodeSonar, that's won a number of awards in this area, have really advanced themselves to help you find those issues. And we've seen very stark examples where we were brought into an organization that was doing avionics software. Software went through full certification, but there were some in-service issues, and CodeSonar was able to find the issue that was creating that, but we also found other issues that were concurrency related. So it's a key area that you should be thinking about. The other thing is not just focusing on source. You also have to think about how do you analyze that binary code that you don't have source for. And again, this is a unique area that CodeSonar can help teams not only analyze their source code, but all that third-party binary code, giving you the ability to do mixed mode analysis where you're actually following a particular control path from your source directly into a library that you might have purchased that you're using. It could be middleware for graphics or other particular things. Then you've got a third category here, very strong verification tools. These are commonly used to verify hardware. The problem with these is they tend to be very, very expensive, and they're not really highly scalable for really large software programs. So we traditionally would point people to this middle category, tools that can certainly scan thousands of lines of code, upwards of multiple millions of lines of code. And again, CodeSonar has been involved in teams that have been able to scan or needed to scan many, many millions of lines of code. Some of the other things that I just want to reinforce that new static analysis tools provide, again, really fall to a number of key areas. Certainly people in the automotive space are going to be worried about coding standards and MISRA compliance. You are going to be looking at concurrency-related issues, whether you're using an ARM processor or a PowerPC or an Intel processor. You're going to be looking for those various things. One of the other areas that's very, very complex but critical for people to think about is control flow and taint data source analysis. And this is the analysis of data packets that are going to enter your system through your defined interfaces and verifying that those packets, whether they're formed correctly or malformed, will actually be properly handled and not create a situation that malformed data could be used as an attack vector to take control over your applications. Now, I mentioned that CodeSonar has been involved in a number of active programs. We're very active in the automotive space, certainly being used by many of the marquee brands. We're being used by Toyota, BMW, Daimler, and many others. But uniquely, Toyota did a study. They've actually done a couple studies where they were looking at a number of key tools. And they did one study that we thought was very interesting where they looked at more than 170 tools that they were using within their QA process. And they found that, they really narrowed it down to six key vendors that had various technologies. And Granitech's Code Sonar was ranked first among the static analysis tools, primarily because of its breadth and level of sophistication to handle standard API problems, but go into concurrency, provide chain analysis, and then provide binary analysis as well. So this is something that for those of you guys looking to improve your capabilities around static analysis, you may want to actually check this report out. I think it's a good read, and it provides a good independent view of what they did. Now, the other thing I just want to mention before I wrap up my session here is the fact that Grammatech also does a tremendous amount of research. Grammatech is a bit of a unique company. We've been around 26 years. It was founded really focusing on research in the static analysis and software assurance area. We still do that today. We're very actively involved in cybersecurity research for a number of government agencies. And, you know, as you can see here, just this year, just recently, I think this last quarter, we were awarded a number of new cybersecurity projects. And these really are critical for us because we take the research that we're doing, we capture the lessons that we learned, and we take some of the IP that we've developed and advanced, and we bring that back into the Code Sonar product line to help solve newer issues that are continually trying to be resolved by academic institutions and a number of key people trying to solve the cybersecurity challenges that we all face today in the marketplace. And just to wrap it up, you know, the other thing I wanted to mention was the fact that Code Sonar is safety certified. I think in many cases, automobiles are going to become more and more regulated, much like we see in the medical space and the aerospace markets. We do have two certification for ISO 26262, which is going to be critical for those people looking to go through safety certification for automobiles. So it's a great additional tool that you can use to provide efficiencies in your own safety certifications and the process that you're going to go through for your advanced automotive software. And so for me, in conclusion, I think the automotive market is certainly in a interesting time. There's a tremendous amount of evolution occurring both from a technology perspective, but also a development in cybersecurity learnings. Grammatech has been here for many, many years, helping out other organizations and markets that have gone through similar pains, whether it's the aerospace, the space, the medical, the industrial automations. And again, there are a lot of overlaps between those challenges that all of you guys are facing in the connected car space that we can bring to bear. And again, we've got good experience that we can also help you guys as you embark on your ADAS or autonomous vehicle function features. So, you know, I would recommend looking at some of the Code Sonar materials online and checking out the independent studies that I mentioned. I think they will be helpful for you if you're in the process of selecting new tools. And with that, Kurt, I'll turn it back to you.
Great. Thanks a lot, Mark. A lot to think about there. Sean is next. Sean.
Thank you, Kurt. Thank you, Mark. That was a great presentation. And just building right on that, we're going to go into looking at how you know, sort of LDRA's view of that perspective. We've been working with in this automotive space for 15, 20 years now. So we'll add a bit more data for you to sift through to figure out how to take to handle these approaches internally for you. So just a little bit about the company. We've been around for 40-plus years, and we've been heavily involved in driving standards. We also came out of a research institution in the University of Liverpool in 1975, and then as flight authority was given to avionics systems, we helped drive the DO-178 standards. And as other standards like 61508 and ISO 26262 came out, our static analysis, dynamic analysis, code coverage, unit testing, and traceability tools really sort of filled out meeting those standards all the way throughout the lifecycle. And then in the late 90s, we got heavily involved with the MISRA standard. Four out of eight or so of the members of the committee actually worked with us. That allowed us to not only drive the standards to the bleeding edge and consolidate information across the industry on what the real best practices are, but also implement them across our tools in a rich and robust and scalable way. So one of the things that's interesting in this picture is that we have our direct offices colored in purple, and we have distributors worldwide. And we found that as we've gotten more and more involved in the automotive space over the last 10, 15 years, that the teams for automotive engineering solutions are highly dynamic, and they're typically spread across multiple geographies, and they're turning out tons and tons of code across distributed teams and having to meet safety-critical standards, security-critical standards, and meet these very, very challenging schedule constraints. So it's a very dynamic market, and we find it to be quite interesting and challenging with all the technology challenges they present. These are some of our members of the MISRA committee, as well as DO-178 and other committees. But one of the things that's really interesting about the list of standards bodies that they and consortiums that they are represented on is that there's a big overlap between those that are on the C standard committee groups, those that are working with CERT and secure coding standards, those that are working with MISRA, and effectively you find that there's a very small community of real thought leaders in key vendor companies, in academia, in industry, that keep crossing paths, and they keep polishing these standards up and building these tools to be able to automate much of this work for yourself. The automotive space in general, and as Mark rightly brought it up, the amount of software is growing at an incredible rate, and all of us really realize that. But when we can start to consider and compare with something like the Joint Strike Fighter, Boeing 787, and realize these cars that we're putting out with a phenomenal number of systems that are highly interconnected within the car, and of course the cars themselves are being connected together, this is a combinatorial explosion of possible number of problems for us to deal with. So we really need to start to frame our development life cycles so they can keep up with this pace of growth and at the same time meet the safety critical and security critical requirements that are essential for tomorrow's challenges. So let's just frame the security critical, what security is. What does it require you to, how does it require you to develop your systems? First, the system itself needs to be reliable, right? It needs to work as its functional requirements expect it to work. It needs to meet standards like ISO 26262 to make sure all functional requirements are properly implemented and so on. The systems that are adjacent to the application that you're building, libraries that you're pulling into, other ECUs you're talking to, CAN bus drivers that you're pulling in, all of that type of stuff, they need to be trustworthy as well, so that they're not inserting any vulnerabilities into your application. So being able to vet all the different adjacent components that you're interfacing with, that's an incredibly important component because it's not totally in your control, but, you know, you're opened up to them. And then, of course, somebody's going to get through who's not trustworthy, who's trying to bombard your interfaces or sneak in one way or another, and they are eventually going to knock you down. The question is, how are you going to get back up? How well will your system recover and resist attacks? So you really need to consider all of these things, and they're all really built on each other. So it's important to kind of frame the problem in that sense. Now, the first thing to keep in mind with security is to make sure that you actually implement security requirements. So just like functional requirements, upfront subject matter expert does the analysis of your system and notes vulnerabilities, understands the attack surface, sees what the interfaces are that could cause problems, and then you write requirements that you will then implement that will close these vulnerabilities and that will make your system more secure, and you'll make sure you implement them and test them just like you do functional requirements. So our TB manager here links into requirement sources that may be coming from Polarian, our partner on the call here, or Word or Excel, or multiple sources, and stitches them all together so you can handle your test management in an automated way and link them to the requirement sources and push the results back into whatever ALM tool you're linked into. So this is a very important part of security, often understated, but if you don't get the security behaviors well understood and then verified, then you're going to leave yourself open to holes. Moving forward in the development lifecycle, when you get into implementation and design, ensuring that you've picked the right coding standard and coding standard set to meet both your safety and security needs, meet your MISRA compliance as well as CERT compliance, for instance, is very important. Be able to deal with legacy code and auto-generated code out of Simulink and Embedded Coder and your brand new hand code that you're writing to MISRA C 2012. Be able to adhere to a coding standard and find runtime errors. All of those things need to be considered at once. And there is no one-size-fits-all. So you do need to think about the demographics and topology of your application and apply these types of automated checks accordingly. But if you do this up front, then you tend to reduce a lot of issues up front. You tend to have consistent coding style that everybody can see and quickly pick up and go instead of trying to decipher somebody's interesting new approach. As you switch out from one piece of hardware to another and you go from 16-bit to 32-bit architecture and your cross-compiler changes, you don't open up latent defects. So there's a lot of ways you can shield yourself by using safety and security critical coding standards up front. You also make testing a lot easier. So drilling down to one example, and this one is caught by various versions of MISRA, is a standard array bounds exceeded, right? We have an array that's going from 0 through 19, and the array itself is, sorry, the loop is going from 0 to 19, and the array itself is only of size 10, and of course you're going to overflow the buffer and write into memory that you didn't expect to write into. Now, that's easy to find in this little code snippet, but those 10 and 20 could, in fact, be preprocessor directives buried four levels deep in a header that's very hard to catch when you glance through it. So these are the types of things that a tool can quickly find for you, and then the human brain can save its energy to think about domain-specific things that a tool doesn't understand how a car is supposed to work. So the idea is to automate as much of this as possible so that you're freed up to do the real engineering work. Just an interesting note, as you see the evolution of MISRA here, going from MISRA 1998 all the way to 2012 and now Amendment 1, which is addressing secure guidelines, the standard is effectively ubiquitous in the automotive industry. So being able to have one set of family of standards that addresses auto-generated code and security and safety for C, C++, and other languages, it's a great place to start if you're out shopping for a coding standard. Another popular coding standard in the secure coding space is CERT. We've been working with the CERT and Carnegie Mellon for about 8 years, and you can see our compliance to the CERT standard on the CERT wiki itself. And the idea here is to have a coding standard focus really on security. And instead of trying to, you know, have one have a panacea standard, and a lot of our customers will use a combination of CERT and MISRA, tailor each how they'd like, and then kind of pick the best of both, and create a coding standard that addresses both up front at the same time. Here's something interesting that Mark brought up a little while ago, the heartbleed problem, and this really had to do with that padding value that you're seeing there not being checked, and that leaving a vulnerability allowing attackers to use this vulnerability in OpenSSL. A couple of interesting points here. OpenSSL and this code was really handled by somebody who was doing the work for free and just sort of helping out the space. And because it says OpenSSL and we've been using it forever, we trust it. And that's one of those trusted pieces of applications that you pull right into your system and you just assume that this is good to go because everybody else is using it. So this issue here at the bottom of the screen is being caught and detected statically. It can also be detected dynamically in runtime through robustness testing. So security issues can be caught at the requirements phase, at the coding standards checking and static analysis, dynamic analysis, unit test at a low-level test level. So you have to consider all the filters through the life cycle and how they can whittle away the types of problems that they're best at solving at that stage. So robustness testing is something that's absolutely necessary to ensure both safety and security, frankly. In this case, what you're looking at is our unit testing tool, which generates a harness around your code and allows you to put inputs and expected outputs and unit test your individual functions and pick up code coverage and then link it to design elements to make sure that those low-level requirements and design elements have been verified. But the inputs for those can also be auto-generated to drive null pointer injection, upper and lower boundary conditions, to really shake the code from both a behavioral standpoint and a security vulnerability standpoint. So the cost of this type of testing is really, really low. And if you catch them early in the process, trying to catch these issues much later at the hardware in the loop or integration level testing or trying to figure out what's going on in the field, that's much, much greater. So I do recommend that you put these additional levels of robustness testing, static level of analysis in place early to filter out these types of issues. Ultimately, though, it's important for you to consider both safety and security holistically. They are two different hats that require two different approaches, but when you figure out exactly how you're going to take that approach with traceability and requirements authoring, verification at a high level or a unit test, you can merge what you intend on doing for safety and security at each one of those points. So you're able to get sort of double bang for the buck for coding standards analysis, for unit testing, for code coverage measurement. And then the artifacts that come out both help you meet your security goals and feed right into a standard like 26262. So when you see security being levied on you all of a sudden in a very complicated security problem, the reality is you can really stretch the boundaries of your existing work you're doing towards meeting safety goals and think with a security hat, and you're really able to get sort of double the value for a small incremental additional amount of work that you're doing. But they are two different subjects, so it's important to think of them from those two different perspectives. You can't just add a little extra to safety and get secure. You have to think from a security perspective. So with that in mind, feel free to reach out to us. We have plenty of videos and white papers and other content on our site ranging from 26262 to security, and we'll be happy to field questions here shortly.
Thanks, Sean. Our next speaker is Mike Borse. Mike.
Well, hello. Thanks for allowing me to participate in today's event and an open discussion about security issues surrounding the connected car. This is obviously a very complicated topic, and we don't have much time to talk about it in any deep detail. I'm going to have to talk pretty fast just to scratch the surface. So one of the things that's notable is if you want to get anybody in the tech sector talking, engage them, bring up the subject of cars. It seems to be the platform of our affection in the software world. So one of the things I think we need to do first is talk about clarify exactly what we mean when we say a connected car. The reality is that the modern automobile is already complexly connected. It's heavily networked with multiple networks. The digitization of virtually every aspect of the vehicle requires inter-vehicle networking of literally hundreds of nodes, of ECUs. Connectivity for these critical elements is so pervasive that it's actually stressing the more common vehicular bus networking architectures, the designs of which really didn't contemplate the high bandwidth traffic or significant numbers of participants. Likely, this is an area that's going to be seeing considerable technological evolution going forward. And combined with all of these requirements, including sensor networking, which is even not mentioned here on this slide, all of this is giving a lot of momentum to Ethernet eventually becoming the standard protocol to accomplish both in-vehicle and exo-vehicle networking. Now, most everybody gets pretty anxious about cybersecurity when we start talking about the car becoming a participant in external networks. A car becomes essentially just another node in the global Internet, and there's an implied recognition that your car is now becoming a target for hackers, just like your laptop or your smartphone. And of course, this has been helped along by the high-profile news stories. Of course, that may or may not be true. Car hacking definitely happens, but interestingly, what's most likely preventing widespread cyber attacks today is that widespread cyber attacks on vehicles is the absence of a way for the hacking world to monetize vehicle hacking, other than outright vehicle theft. So even how a car actually gets connected to the Internet is not universal. For example, let's consider a driver who has a smartphone, and he's in his car, and that smartphone is connected to both the car's infotainment system via Bluetooth as well as to the Internet over the 4G cellular network. Well, doesn't that make the car now a so-called connected car in terms of being on the Internet, despite the car itself potentially not having direct wireless capabilities? So some researchers estimate that somewhere between 25 and 30% of new vehicles connect to the Internet via smartphones today. So my takeaway here is that connected cars are unique in networking realms, not only for the diversity of networks within the car, which need to be protected from one another, as well as potentially allowing for managed and authenticated interoperability, but as well because the reality is that there are so many ways cars are connected, and yet there's no universal ways and means by which most networking is implemented. So everything we think we understand about security, based mostly upon experiences in other networking realms, is subject to rethinking when we start talking about connected cars. Even telematics, which ostensibly are benign, expose a number of heretofore untalked about risks like spoofing, location data, as well as some potential privacy concerns. So the connected car presents many constraints that need to be understood, plus many opportunities that are probably worthy of some exploration. We just can't take the same physical infrastructure that brings the Internet to the world and stuff it inside of a car. First off, the environmental conditions in a car are extreme by any measure. It's also a hotbed of radio frequency interference. So potentially everything from wiring insulation to interface connectors is going to have to get reworked and made into vehicle grade. This then becomes a potential issue in the total car manufacturing process because the wiring itself is weight. The existing wiring harness is 50 kilograms, hundreds of pounds. So weight affects mileage and battery life. I mean, it becomes a cascade of trade-offs. Bandwidth is a similar set of concerns in terms of trade-offs. The usual, and as network traffic becomes more sophisticated, particularly with the introduction of more active safety systems, the usual compression and buffering techniques that optimize networks will require increasingly greater processing power at the end node level, which means ECUs will need to be made more complex with more software. More code obviously means more testing using tools like from LDRA or Gramatech. But even then, greater vulnerabilities and defect risks are typically introduced with more software. And then there's cost. What does all this technology do to the price of a vehicle? Sure, you can put a sophisticated fiber optic physical network layer in a car and provide isolation and bandwidth, but that may jack up the price of the car so much that it makes it unaffordable to your target market, or it eats into the car model's profit margin. Cost considerations spill over into maintainability. The longevity of cars is considerably longer than other devices. This maintenance, particularly the ongoing responsibility of updating the onboard software, is probably going to outstrip the industry's current service delivery capabilities. So new modes will have to be pioneered, new modes of service delivery and software updating. And then there's greater subtleties with respect to the human-machine interfacing that will need to be determined. I mean, how much do we want the driver involved in security threat mitigation? In theory, the driver's already preoccupied safely operating a moving multi-ton machine. We already know there's a lot of other activities going on inside the car that are distractful. We want to make sure that whatever is going on with respect to security management does not contribute to those levels of distraction. So the plus side is that the things that are pulling people into connected cars are extremely compelling. So probably the most interesting thing is that the car is going to become a platform for addressing an audience that's a captive audience. Like it or not, we're a captive audience sitting inside of our car some 15 hours a week on average. So this is going to be a huge pull, as well as the optimization of public infrastructure. What's the old story about the 70-year-old living in Paris their whole life? They will have spent 7 to 10 years of their life looking for parking. You can imagine that a connected vehicle scenario would simply optimize the public infrastructure. So are we ready? Our best practices that we followed up to this point, are they ready for this new set of challenges? We're going to have to rethink everything about cybersecurity, about the nature of vulnerabilities. Perhaps the biggest vulnerability, quite honestly, is the automotive industry's reliance upon a very diverse and lengthy supply chain. The buck may stop at the OEM, but responsibility for cybersecurity is spread over many, many participants, which presents, this actually presents more management issues than technology issues. Many threats are not going to involve attacks as we understand them today. Authentication will remain a difficult problem. Machine-to-machine authentication, both within the car and then outside outside of the car, allowing for interoperability. This, as mentioned, updating the car, updating the software that's in the car is going to be a major concern. The auto industry has many established risk and quality management practices. Will they be enough to address cybersecurity concerns? Cybersecurity will need to be take a very prominent role in all of the risk management that's currently in place. So risk management is really the key. It's the quantification involved in vehicle development to quantify risk and assess it and mitigate it. All of the testing and validation that's done in automotive, in many cases, using the tools that are mentioned on this call, like from Gramatrek and LDRA, will need to be applied in an orchestrated, precise, process-wide approach to address security concerns. So fundamentally, security has got to become integrated into the development lifecycle, and management of that lifecycle itself must be flexible and resilient. It must enforce both coding structure, coding standards. It has to be extremely powerful in order to address the concerns that are going to be presented with cybersecurity. As far as standards, I mean, there are many standards. There's going to be many more in the future. There's going to be a regulatory landscape that's going to include government agencies and legally required, legally mandated steps. In the USA, for example, there's already been a Spy Car Act that was introduced in 2015 mandating protection against hacking and isolation of critical and non-critical software systems. Certainly well-intentioned, but probably short on technical specifications, potentially out of date by the time it becomes law. The reality is that there's no silver bullet. There's no recognized de facto standards. Instead, there's many groups coming at cybersecurity in connected cars from many different angles, often with variations in approaches. There's uneven adoption, OEMs in some global regions, but not others. It's really a soup of acronyms, both new emerging standards as well as adaptation of existing standards. So the point being is that process flexibility and adaptability will be key for all participants. Otherwise, you risk adopting standards and practices that change or disappear entirely, and you can't alter your development life cycles quickly enough to respond accordingly. Cybersecurity has enormous implications for mechanical elements, so there needs to be tight integration between physical and software engineering with enhanced utilization of modeling as a way to ensure security risks are mitigated. So implementing security for connected cars really involves process, architecture and design plus technology. The usual picture is a three-legged chair or stool. If one leg is shorter than the other, the stool is unsteady or can topple over. In other words, you could have the most secure architecture implemented using the latest technology and tools, but if the process by which it's implemented is weak, then ultimately what's delivered will be a disappointment or worse, a disaster. So Polarion ALM really was the first holistic ALM solution. For the last decade plus, we've been unlocking lifecycle synergies involving full traceability, secure collaboration. Sean mentioned the distributed nature of the development teams. We provide a collaborative, easy-to-access environment that allows for the management of disparate teams. We've been deployed in countless customer settings in all industry sectors, particularly poignant in automotive. We have some 200-plus extensions and connectors that provide a rich ecosystem that allows tool chains to be interoperable, connecting with testing tools. It's a methodologically independent approach. We don't enforce any particular methodology upon a development environment. And as testimony to our capabilities in this area, we were recently acquired by the Siemens Corporation and now become a Siemens company. So there's an opportunity for very strong integration with product lifecycle management as well. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Kurt.
Great. Thanks a lot, Mike. Our next speaker is Bob Lee. Bob.
Hi. Thank you. So I've got a few slides here. I want to leave enough time for questions at the end. So feel free to reach out to me at the end. My email address will be at the end of the slides if you want more information that we can't cover in these slides. So first off, my name is Bob Lee. I'd like to talk to you about RTI and our work in security and securing communications. A little bit of background on RTI. We are a software middleware company supporting the DDS standard, which is an open standard supported by more than 10 different vendors in the ecosystem and in the market. We're perhaps the largest, or are the largest, and we work across a variety of industries, including automotive, healthcare, communications, defense, industrial, and energy. We're very involved in standards and consortia efforts. Interoperability and open systems are very important to our company and our approach to these systems. And many of our customers are using our software in applications that are mission critical and safety critical. We're operating in trillions of dollars worth of product worldwide in avionics applications that need safety certification, in secure applications such as operating a large dam in the U.S. that is definitely vulnerable to, or not vulnerable, but definitely a concern in terms of infrastructure attacks and how we approach these applications in relation to cybersecurity is very important. So when we look at the industrial IoT, which is the market we address and included in that is connected cars, what are we really looking for in terms of a system? Well, reliability is key. These are usually critical infrastructure systems. Scalability is important. As we connect systems, we need to grow and scale our applications. Safety is usually paramount in many of these applications, especially in the area of transportation and aviation. Security is becoming a much greater concern than perhaps it has been in the past. Not that it wasn't important, but as we have more connected devices and more devices on a open network, then we really have to take security seriously. And then resiliency. These systems are important that they're running 24/7 and constantly available. So when we look at security, it's important to say we need to make them secure, but we can't compromise reliability and resiliency in the name of security. So we can't reboot the computer if it's compromised. We can't close off a network just to prevent an attack, because that will take the operations down. So we have to think about security in a different way than we have in traditional IT systems. So what does RTI do? What is our software all about? Well, fundamentally, we're about sharing data between applications, and those could be networked applications, those could be systems of systems application, or they could be embedded device applications. And the best way to think of our system is compare it to a database, compare our software to a database. Traditionally, or in very simple systems, you might share data or archive data in unstructured files. We call this data at rest. It's historic data. It's used to look back at trends at how system evolves or changes. As you scale your network, as you scale your application, as you look to create a more sophisticated environment, you'll probably move to a database. And with today's databases, we can achieve, you know, a massive scale. We ensure interoperability between different applications that need to share data. We ensure the longevity of that data and that configuration by maintaining information about the data model and how to access data over time that can, you know, evolve and change as our architecture changes. So it's a very powerful system. And the other thing about a database is we can use a database to control access to data. So authentication is really part of many database applications. Well, RTI's software, our Connex DDS SDK and toolkits, are analogous to databases. When we look at unstructured files, we can compare those to traditional messaging middleware. Client-server is one architecture that's very common, where we take data and we encapsulate it and we send it out over a wire, and we have to bundle it and unbundle it at each end to ensure that we can get that data. And usually when we think about security, we just wrap those messages in a secure and encrypted way, and then we add authentication on top of that. Well, for us, supporting the DDS standard, we think of it differently. We have a data bus architecture, a data-centric data bus architecture that's analogous to a database, in that the data bus understands the data, there's structure to the data, we're sharing data in its native format, we can control access to that data right in the communication protocol, and we can scale and allow interoperability integration across multiple applications, multiple systems, and very large networks. And then the difference between us and an actual database is we're dealing with data in motion instead of data at rest, or real-time data, data that has a fixed life, where it's important to get data from source to destination within a certain period of time and a certain level of quality, like low latency and a certain reliability. It's important to point out that DDS is a communication standard. It stands for Data Distribution Service, and it's managed by the OMG, the Object Management Group. These are all the different components of the DDS standard that are part of this family of standards, and one of those you see right in the middle here is DDS security. So DDS is a publish-subscribe middleware. It has a wires protocol. It has an API protocol. It has support for multiple transport layers, and then added on to this, which was just approved in the last year, is the DDS Secure standard. And this embeds security right into the DDS protocol. It sits between the application and the transport layer. And the way RTI architects this is we build libraries into the application. So that encryption and that security for your communication becomes part of the application itself as you deploy your system using these libraries. So this becomes a very powerful tool, and as I move on here to the next slides, we'll see that it gives us much more flexibility in how we define security and control security. So when we look at a connected vehicle application, we've really got multiple networks, multiple hierarchies of data, starting with the in-car platform, and then we look at V2V and V2X applications where we're communicating with infrastructure and other vehicles. We have fleet management applications. We're connecting cars to closed private networks to or virtual private networks to manage the location of cars, manage receive telematic information, and provide other value to our to customers. And then at the top level, perhaps we have the public internet or the World Wide Web, where we're now open to public access, and either directly or indirectly, we can access this car platform through these different layers. So in all of these levels, there are different qualities of service or different criteria we have for communication. Sometimes we need fast communication and low latency. Sometimes we want seamless integration across systems. But at all levels, we need security. And that security may be different for an in-car platform versus public internet, but they all require some level of security and some thought into how we approach security. So the connected car definitely adds new challenges to the idea of security compared to traditional and even other infrastructure applications. We have this integration from the sensor to the cloud. We have multiple attack surfaces, not only connecting through wireless and radio or the internet, but also potential malicious actors can access cars themselves or devices within the car, such as a GPS system or a telematic system, and really have full control over those to discover vulnerabilities and exploit those without anybody really being aware that those attacks are taking place until they've learned enough about the system to take action. So this means we really need to look at all these attack surfaces and how do we connect these cars. We might say the risk is fairly low today. We haven't seen much of that. But when we look at connecting autonomous cars in the futures, where we have connected cars that are continuously accessing the World Wide Web, and then autonomous cars that have the ability to control steering and braking and navigation, now we have a much higher risk that we need to look at in a different way. So here's an example architecture of a connected autonomous car. Right in the center, you have a communication bus that connects different applications within the autonomous car with each other and connected through a router or some other service. RTI has something called a routing service that allows you to connect different domains and different parts of your network across routers and across systems connected to a cloud service. So we need to look at each of these components and decide, what security is needed? Do we need authentication? Do we need encryption? How do we control that access, but still allow systems to operate even in the face of an attack so that we can at least get to a safe mode or a safe state? It's not acceptable just to turn off the car and have it stop. It needs to move to the side of the road. It needs to be in a safe mode, and we need to ensure that we have systems that are going to support those applications. So how do we handle this security? I think it's useful to look at security on a network in three levels. First, there's boundary security, which is similar to encrypting your Wi-Fi connection, where you just encrypt the whole network and you ensure that no one can get in. Well, this is a good first step, but we know that it's fairly easy to break into a network. There are many access points and isn't where we need to. We need to move beyond just boundary security. Second layer would be transport level security, where we build security into the transport levels themselves. This is a fairly blunt instrument in what we're using. It's going to add encryption and overhead to our communications traffic, which may be necessary in some cases, but may not be in all cases. And then the third area we should look at is fine-grained security, where we can look at what type of data is being sent, who should have access to that data, and ensure that we build our system to meet those rules. And so that's where the Connect DDS Secure comes in, which is our secure product that supports the DDS Secure standard. So the scenario that I think is really illustrative is if we've got a number of actors on a network, they each have different roles to play. They may be able to write data. They may only be able to read data. They may be allowed to read or write data. If we just look at a boundary or transport security, usually anybody that's on the network has the ability to read just about everything on that network, and may be able to imitate other actors to be able to write to data that's on that network that they shouldn't. And this is the level of fine-grained security that we really need in the next generation of industrial solutions, especially in connected cars. So in this example, Trudy does not have permission to write to the network, and Mallory may have permission to read but not has permission to write. How do we ensure that each of these actors are only working within the bounds of their permission set in the data model? We don't want to assume that every local machine should be trusted. We really want to ensure that every actor is only working within their set of rules and systems. So this is where DDS Secure comes in, where we can define security as a quality of service, just like the data rate or the latency required for a system or the bandwidth that the system is allowed to use. We can define a system as only a writer or only a reader or only a reader and writer on each data topic that exists on that network. So when we look at different actors, they may have permission to read, may have permission to write, and using DDS Secure, we can define them, define those properties, but also set whether encryption is needed or authentication is needed, and define how we encrypt those systems. And this is very important for bandwidth considerations and latency considerations. We may not care if a control signal is encrypted or not, so by making it unencrypted, then we can ensure that there's lower latency and lower overhead on that signal, but we still want to ensure that we have authentication. So we can ensure the authentication is secured, but the data itself does not need to be encrypted. And this is the type of practical fine-grained security that DDS Secure allows. In another example, we may want to encrypt the data where we have either private information or data about location, and we want to encrypt that. So even if someone was to access the network, they still can't see what the data contained in these packets. So, in summary, when we look at a connected car, there's multiple attack surfaces, and many may be exposed publicly. So, we need to really consider how are our different actors going to access the system, and even if they do access that system, how do we contain them and really move our system into a safe state? A system needs reliable, flexible, and real-time connectivity. This is both within the car as well as to other infrastructure actors and other systems outside of the car. And it really needs to be part of the architecture of the design. One of the key things in our approach is you can drop in security at any point. It doesn't have to be built during your prototyping and evaluation stage. DDS Secure is fully compatible with standard DDS. Products, we're just adding a security layer into the architecture. So this can be added at a later date to give maximum flexibility during the prototyping and development lifecycle. So that is the end of my presentation. Thanks everyone for listening. If you want to reach out to me, please do. And I'd like to thank everyone for listening. Back over to you, Kurt.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bob. I am sorry we actually went right through the entire presentation, but lots of great content. We didn't want to rob anyone of being able to see all of it. We did get questions. I want to let the audience know that these panelists and their companies can be reaching out to you, and you can reach out to them as well to get those questions answered. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast version will also be made available there. Thank you, everyone, for attending, and have a great day.